until they leveled them to put in the road. Cedric Clyde was responsible for that, too. At least that's what I heard. He had a lot of power with the County Board of Supervisors, and he had that road put in where he did because it was the most convenient way for taking produce back out to the old state highway. I don't suppose he thought anything at all about plowing down those old mounds. Dorian said that although tribal cultures varied greatly and although it was impossible to lump their beliefs together in one creed, nearly all Indians honored their ancestors. Their burial grounds were sacred, and so the seemingly incidental direction left on Indian Mound Road had drawn Dorian into Jason's story more than anything else. It had provided the framework for listening to the entire story. Dorian heard it as a tale of white people fighting over whose tribe would be honored, the ancestral tribe of the Clyde, symbolized by the couch, or the invading tribe of the former suburbanites who were displacing the natives by buying out their foreclosed farms. To Dorian, it seemed like a recapitulation of what had happened to tribe after tribe as they were displaced by white settlers. Dorian said, "This is the task of proclaiming the gospel into the 21st century, to raise from oblivion the people who have been plowed over." Then Dorian paused for a long, long time. Finally, he spoke again. "When I went off to college, I had a friend who asked me, 'Why do Indians dance? Why do they wear headdresses?' He meant no harm. He was just interested. I had to tell him I didn't know. But I went home and started asking the elders about this. It was then that I realized that preaching had done my people harm as well as good. The preaching I grew up with was like acid rain. It was giving life and corroding life at the same time. If we're going to preach the gospel into the 21st century, we need to purify the rain, to cleanse our preaching voices from the acids of prejudice and superiority that have poisoned preaching in the past." Peter Linden sat there and felt simultaneously burdened down and lifted up. The burden was the weight of the past and all the harm that Christian preaching had done. The lifting up was the witness of the past to the glory of God and all the good that Christian preaching had done. And feeling both burdened and lifted at the same time, Peter caught the full measure of sorrow and hope which sounded in Dorian White Elk as he finished speaking. "But not all Indian Christians are opposed to the old ways, as some of my brothers and sisters are. There are those like myself who want to bring into the same circle our ancient tribal traditions and the gospel of Jesus Christ, while still others will have nothing to do with Christianity because of what it has done to us in the past. The wind blows in many directions at once. I suppose that's why I signed up for Preachers in Search of Their Voices, because I wonder as a preacher, what kind of preaching can hold our people together when things fall apart?" Dorian's concluding words, "when things fall apart," the class nearly fell apart as they all spoke at once, describing how their world and their churches were falling apart. When the class quieted down, Dorian said to Roger Hawkins, who was seated next to him, "Tell him what you were just saying." Every face turned toward Roger Hawkins. Senior pastor of a church in the upscale suburb of Grafton Heights, Roger was a tall, lanky man with dark blue eyes that matched the pinstripe suits he usually wore to class. That first day of class, Roger was on crutches because he had sprained his ankle playing squash with one of the church trustees at the Y. He had joked with the class when he entered the room saying, "The old body ain't what it used to be." But there was no levity in his voice as he responded to Dorian and explained to the whole class how things were falling apart in the suburb of Grafton Heights. Although every house looked as trim and neat as the set for a standard television sitcom, in truth, everything was in pieces. His people's lives were fragmented by an endless scramble to make more, own more, do more, be more. "I remember a few years ago when I took another course here at the seminary," said Roger. "It was in systematics on the doctrine of humanity. I was desperate to understand how people could have so much and be so empty. We were reading Reinhold Niebuhr's The Nature and Destiny of Man, and I came upon words that leapt from the page. They said something like this: 'The rich man always wants more riches. The husband married to a beautiful wife wants one more beautiful. The great landowner seeks to add yet another field to his estate.' And then it said, and I am certain these are the exact words: 'This incessant pursuit of an ever-fugitive satisfaction springs from troubled deeps in human nature.' Those scant words are one of the two sermons that stand out in my life. The other was not from a book. It was a sermon I heard preached when we were taking the children on a tour of historic sites and parks. We found ourselves one warm Sunday morning driving through a suburb like Grafton Heights. We stopped to go to church. As we entered, the first thing we saw in the narthex is a large poster announcing the Crafts Bazaar and Strawberry Social. Alice says to me, "Are we pulling a camper behind us or the Grafton Heights congregation?" They even sang the same hymns at the same tempo. Perhaps because it seemed a mere reflection of the church I serve, and perhaps because the preacher was about my age and build, the whole service gave me the uncanny feeling of looking into myself leading Sunday worship. But all this changed with the sermon. I always begin with the biblical text, but this preacher did not speak about the Bible until the very end. Instead, he starts telling us about his vacation that was just over. He had spent some time in the city and seen a play entitled That Championship Season. At first, I began to wonder when he was going to bring in the Bible. But after a few minutes, I did not worry anymore because I found myself completely caught up in the sermon. And I could tell the whole congregation was with him all the way. You did not hear the rustling of a single bulletin. The play is about a basketball team that has won the state championship about 20 years earlier. The plot hooked me because I was center on my high school team when I was growing up. In the play, four of the starters and the coach get together on the anniversary of the championship game. They listen to a recording of the radio broadcast and celebrate the victory once again. But it turns out they cheated to win. A black player on the other team was dominating the game, so they deliberately tripped him to put him out of commission. The fifth starter on the team, the one who never returns for the anniversary celebrations, later went to the coach and asked him to confess their dirty play and to return the trophy. But the coach never did. He and the others kept up the myth that they were the greatest. Their careers have subsequently followed the pattern of that game, win at all costs. They never allow integrity or decency or compassion to get in the way of what they want. The lurid details of their adult lives keep seeping out as the play continues. But in the final scene, they cannot face up to the truth. They gather around the old trophy and sing the school song and hang on to the lie. I remember sitting there in the pew realizing I had never listened to a sermon so intensely in my entire life. And then I wondered, but was it a sermon? Where's the gospel? And just as I was asking this, just as my heart and mind were thirsting for some redemptive possibility, which the play never offers, just then, the preacher moves aside his notes and finds his place in the pulpit Bible. I wonder, what's he going to read? I look to the left. I look to the right in the pews around me. Every face I see appears to be saying, there's got to be more. Something from God. Tell us. The preacher reads in a calm voice at a slow speed. What does it profit them if they gain the whole world but lose or forfeit themselves? Let whoever has ears to hear, hear. I receive those words like a thirsty man dying for a drink. Roger ended the sermon and reflected, here's why I signed up for this course, because I want my preaching to help my people find the center. Then Roger Hawkins turned to Catherine and said, you taught college English. Isn't there some famous poem about everything coming apart and the center giving way? It was required reading when I took an intro course to modern lit in college. Yeats, The Second Coming, Catherine said right away. I can't quote the whole thing, but I remember the lines that I think you mean. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. That's the poem, said Roger. Anarchy loosed upon the world. I see it behind the manicured lawns and the well-trimmed hedges of Grafton Heights. I drive by those places and I think of a woman whose husband beat her up last week after they gave a cocktail party for 75. I see another couple, the woman crying, the man's face a stone. Their son has been busted for his part in a crack ring. I listen to members of my congregation with six-figure incomes who cannot afford a pledge of more than 2% because of the mortgage on their second home. I see the town meeting last month and the people shouting down the supervisor who had sponsored a group home in Grafton Heights. Yes, the ceremony of innocence. I had forgotten that phrase. The ceremony of innocence is drowned in my people's broken lives. Things fall apart the sinner cannot hold. Like I said, that's why I'm here, to figure out how to regain the center. For a moment, the members of the class were busy writing notes, asking Catherine to repeat the lines from the poem and getting the name of the play from Roger. All of them in your notes. While the students wrote, Peter became aware of the ticking of the oak-framed wall clock which had been saved from the old seminary, reconditioned and hung along with the historic photographs of the campus and its early graduates. The gentle tick-tock almost seemed to emanate from the picture of the granite Victorian building that had dominated the old campus. It was as if the past were holding on to the present by the faintest possible pulse, and only by the deliberate act of rewinding it once a week did the thing keep beating. Is that what preaching would become? Rewinding the old ecclesiastical clock to soften the present with an antique sound? Would the voices of preachers be as dated as that old relic? Or would proclaiming the gospel into the 21st century bring wind, bring fire? Peter left class that day, his question filling his heart, and his question turned into a prayer to God, and his prayer turned into a hymn, Spirit of the Living God, fall afresh on me. And so that we can pray along with Peter Linden, let us end by singing twice through hymn number 244. Number 244. Spirit of the Living God, fall fresh on all of us who preach your word, that we may declare it faithfully. Jesus Christ may be Savior, and you may be praised forever and ever. Amen.